Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 267 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host once again. And today my guest is Robert Siglimpaglia. Now, Robert, or Rob, is an attorney out of the Sanford, Connecticut area, who also happens to be a voiceover actor and film actor and now producer and what have you, an author, dealing with the entertainment law aspects of voiceover work. His book is called Voiceover Legal. And we delve here in this conversation about, you know, his whole legal career. He does workers' comp primarily and how that got started. And then how he also started doing voiceover work and then became known as the lawyer for the voiceover industry. And in the entertainment industry became the voiceover actor who also happens to be a lawyer. So a very synergistic approach to melding those two aspects of his business model. So interesting conversation. I think you'll get a kick out of listening to Robert Siglimpaglia. Rob Siglimpaglia, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you very much, Neil, for having me.
I try to do that pretty precisely and slowly, but Rob, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. Yeah. I've been practicing law for 30 years now, unbelievably. I'm a workers' compensation specialist at this point in my career. Mm-hmm. And I also have ventured into entertainment law because I started doing voiceover work back in mid-2000s. And that led into some acting, on-camera acting, and full-on production of film and TV shows that I do now. I've been doing that for the past 5 years or so. Those are my main practice areas: workers' comp, entertainment. I do a little real estate, mm-hmm. and enjoy life.
It's interesting because I've always felt that, particularly for those of us who litigate or have litigated, been in the courtroom, that there's a theatrical component to the practice of law that is undeniable.
Absolutely. 1,000%. Yeah. If you, acting is all about being vulnerable and making a connection with your audience. And that's exactly what any good litigator needs to do. They need to connect with the jury, the court, you know, they need to tell their client's story. And as an actor, you're telling the writer's story, not your own. So it very much parallels. In fact, I taught a seminar last year before COVID about, acting and the litigator. And I, the course was, I had, attorneys, do monologues.
Right.
And so, you know, I encouraged them to memorize it, but you know, they didn't have to, and right, you know, right, just went over there, all the things that an actor thinks about or tries not to think about, you know, body, language and things like that. And they, so they could see the parallels for themselves.
To the extent that lawyering is the art of persuasion, then, you know, acting is really also, you know, the manifestation of how to persuade somebody to believe the story that you're trying to tell.
Correct. Right. It's not really persuasion in the way that a layman thinks about it.
Right.
It's more you're persuading by connecting, by telling the truth, and by making sense. And that's all the things that a good actor needs to do. They need to be truthful and real and make sense, and you know, and have feelings that the audience can feel, can, because you're portraying those feelings by being real and genuine. So all those things lawyers need to do in order to to be a good lawyer. Otherwise, you're just standing up there, you know, reading something off a piece of paper, or on the other side, an actor is just saying their lines. They're not, you know, if they don't get those elements, it's not effective.
Right. They don't get the job.
Correct.
You know, oftentimes. So let's circle back and let's go back to when you got started. You went to law school. Did you always know in law school that you wanted to be a solo attorney, or did you envision going to a big firm, or how did that happen?
It's actually a good lead into what we were talking about. So when I was in law school, I was a clerk for an insurance company, and I was doing insurance defense work, and I really liked it. And I was doing that for like 2 years, and that should have led to a job. However, when I graduated, it was one of the economic recessions that we were in. So not only did I not get offered a job, the firm I was working for eliminated a few attorneys. So at that point, I decided, you know, I really couldn't find any work at that point in time. So I said, you know what, I'm going to go out on my own. I'm going to see how it works.
And were you always at that point in the New York area?
Yes, I was in Connecticut, Stamford, Connecticut.
Okay.
That's where I started. And what I did.
Where'd you go to law school?
Pace University. I read the book, How to Go Into Your Own Practice Without Missing a Meal or a Bite. Yeah. I read that book. And what that book talks about is to try to find an office where there are other attorneys so that you can rent space from them and then try to get them to give you some work. And that's how I started. So I went into an office that had four or five other attorneys. They did a lot of real estate. So that's where I started. That's where I learned real estate, because they gave me some closings. And then after 6 months, they gave me a job offer. So I started working there. And then about 2 years later, the firm broke up. So I went back out on my own in the same place I was.
Changed the nameplate on the door, right?
Exactly. And I stayed there until about 6-7 years later. I got a call from my original boss from when I was in law school, saying she was one of the ones that was let go too, but she got hired back. Would you like to have that job that you didn't get back when you were clerking here? So I decided I really liked that insurance defense. So I decided to move, and I made the move and went corporate for a little while. That's where I learned workers' comp very well.
Okay.
Because I was doing all the comp hearings. I would do 10.
And it's a natural extension from insurance defense or personal injury.
Right. Well, that's what we did comp, and we did all, you know, property, auto accidents. So I was doing both, but I really started concentrating more on comp. I jumped into one of the associates role where I was, that's where I concentrated, because I wanted to get my certification. So, you know, that's why, right. one of the reasons why I said I wanted to do that. Plus I like the comp practice here in Connecticut, at least, is so much more relaxed and informal than the Superior Court practice.
It's interesting. Let me pick at that a little bit. You mentioned certification. Is Connecticut one of the jurisdictions in which you can obtain a certification in a law specialty?
Yes.
Okay.
Workers' comp is one of them. Yes.
And workers' comp is one of them. Okay. So that was kind of your justification. And then I know here in where I practice, the workers' comp is, I wouldn't say largely form driven, but there's a lot of form based aspects to litigating a workers' comp case. Is that similar in Connecticut?
I mean, there are a lot of forms, but when you're, the forms are pretty routine. You know, it's kind of like a summons, you know,
is
the form 30C to start the case. Then you get the form 36 where they're trying to cut off benefits or change benefits, the insurance company, or form 43 when they're denying something. Those are the main forms. Other than that, it's, you know, it's, but if you're litigating a case, you're not really relying on forms at all.
It's, but you can get a lot of work done in more standardized approach in workers' comp here. So is that what lends itself to a little more relaxed atmosphere, as you said?
Yes, but it's also like we do a lot of informal hearings, and now they've been doing informal hearings by phone.
Sure.
Because of COVID, and then we're talking about now keeping it that way for the most part, because it's been very efficient. And they've actually been doing formal hearings by Zoom over the past, since last August. So But even when you go in live, it's not the same. I mean, obviously the rules of evidence apply, but they're more relaxed. Right. So there's more leeway for the lawyers and for the commissioners to, you know, to accept exhibits and things like that. And then the informals, I mean, you just go in and, hey, commissioner, I need this done today. And the other side's okay, you know, yes or no. And,
yeah.
You know, you talk to them argument. All the time, you know, you know, it's an argument, but it's, you know, it's basically just a normal conversation. You know, no one's arguing.
Yeah.
It's just very relaxed.
Let your position be known and move on from there. It's interesting that's the approach. Okay, so you wanted to get your certification. You really enjoyed the workers' comp aspect of it. And so you went back to your original firm. And how long did you stay with them?
I was there for 5 years. Then I decided that I was going to get the certification and I wanted to actually move on to the other side, the plaintiff side. So I did a little transition for a couple of years with another firm. And that was when I started doing the voiceovers and the acting.
Okay.
And that jumped me into my next, where I am right now, the next phase. And because what had happened was I was working for a firm. I was doing plaintiff's work. I had some of my own clients. But I had started doing the voiceovers and the acting. And by March of, I think it was 2005, I had already used up all my vacation time from, you know, auditioning and doing jobs for acting. So I had gotten an offer from Disney to do 13 days work on the film Enchanted. You know, so I was like, that's great. I told my wife, and I was like, I can't do that. I don't have any more vacation time left. And she said to me, quit that job. She knew how much I hated, you know, working the grind. She's like, quit. You're going to have a chance to do a Disney film. If you're in that film, we can show that to our grandkids. This is like a chance of a lifetime. She goes, you could go back on your own. She knew I was, you know, what I had done before. Go back on your own. Just go call one of my friends that actually asked me to go in and rent office space with him before I took that job after Traveler. So I just called him and he said, oh yeah, the space is still here. So I transitioned, went back and right in like one day, it was like I was back on my own in an office space independently renting it and pursuing my dream, you know, the acting and the voiceover.
So. Well, it's kind of ironic that, you know, oftentimes we who are betrothed to a spouse, we're limited by that constraint. You may not feel like you have the freedom or the flexibility because you have family to think about. You have a marriage to deal with. But when it's your spouse pounding on the table saying, quit that job, let's go for it, that's pretty much licensed to carry on.
Well, I mean, and at the time I had 10-year-old twins and a 5-year-old daughter. So I had 3 daughters at the time. But this is the caveat that she said. So this was my only condition. Just don't miss a mortgage payment.
Yeah.
That was it. So she was basically saying, if you can, you know, if you have enough clients to go on your own, go for it. If we could pay the bills, which she knew I had, you know, that's why I got the certification. That's why I went through all that process before, you know, and I was doing voiceover work. So I was getting, you know, I had income there too. So it wasn't like I was starting from scratch and having zero. I was just making a conversion. I was just transitioning. So
I want to come back to the entertainment law and the voiceover work in a moment and the whole acting scheme, because as listeners know, that's near and dear to my heart. I have an adult daughter who's a musical theater performer on the West Coast. So that's something that really interests me, and we probably spend the whole time talking about that. But I want to kind of wrap up and have a better sense of your legal profession now. So you're in Stanford, you're doing, you've got your own firm, you're doing workers' comp. Have you remained a solo, or do you have staff or virtual assistants, or how is your office currently structured?
Yeah, actually my main office is down in Norwalk. I do have a Stanford office. I have an office in New York City. I use all virtual assistants.
Okay.
I have virtual.
When did you start using virtuals?
Oh, a while ago. I actually, you know, everyone's talking about the virtual office now, but I started when I moved that other firm that I was telling you about, you know, the attorney friend of mine, I left his firm in 2014 and I got a virtual office. So that's when I started the whole virtual office thing back in 2014. And I've been saying for you know, all this time that this is the way to practice law. This is the way of the future. And then when COVID hit, everyone's talking about virtual office. And, you know, so I started, I've been using virtual assistants since 2014.
So you started your office in a virtual office, kind of a shared workspace like Regis or WeWork, correct, something like, correct, that.
Okay. Correct.
So you work primarily from home. You went into the office when you needed to meet clients. You got your mail at the office, that kind of thing.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. And what were the tools that allowed you to do all of that? What principally did you use in order to remain mobile?
Well, First of all, it was necessity because I was traveling all around. You know, yeah. I was going out to Los Angeles and things for at the acting.
Sure.
So
you had to be able to apply your legal trade from wherever you were at the time.
Right. So I practiced law from the plane. I was practicing law from the plane. I still practice law from the plane.
Right.
So I've been a big technology lover, embracer since I first started practicing. I had the first laser printer from HP that came off. Like I made my father go pick it up for me.
And I remember those HP laser printers were pretty big.
Clunky and slow.
About the size of a small oven.
Yeah, it was exactly. I was printing out my own mortgage papers off of that too. Like I copied all the fonts from the forms that you typed up, and I was starting to embrace the technology.
Okay.
Even before that, but I mean, when I started practicing, I carried it in. So I had all my systems set up, you know, my Dropbox, my Box, my Cryptor, all the systems to make me completely 100% online. I keep paper files, but it's just a backup, really. I can do everything from online. So, right. And I could, you know, I could email from wherever I am in a plane if I have to.
So basically you just need an internet connection.
Internet connection, phone. I do, you know, a lot of work on my smartphone, obviously laptop. And the virtual assistants back when I started, it was just starting. So they were more live assistants, even though they were not your employees, you know, right. So you'd still talk to them on the phone and have, you know, maybe Kevin come into the office and show them what you need to do. Now it's all virtual, you know, which is, you don't even have to leave. I don't have to leave home. It's great.
This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by Center Stage and the Law Firm Marketing Minute, two great podcasts produced by Spotlight Branding. We're a legal marketing company providing content marketing for law firms that actually works. And we created these shows as a free resource to help lawyers like you learn more about marketing and business development. Every Monday, the Law Firm Marketing Minute arrives with a short 10-minute dose of marketing tips and inspiration to help you grow your firm. On Wednesdays, Center Stage arrives with perspective from other lawyers and legal industry experts to help you tackle marketing and other business development challenges. Check both of these shows out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and more. Both shows make great companions for the law entrepreneur, so subscribe today. Hope to see you there soon.
Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And this episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the all-in-one contact relationship manager, or CRM. I've been using Daylight for well over 10 years now, and it's the best CRM for business on the Mac and iPhone. And despite having a case management platform that I'm very happy with, I still use Daylight to handle all of my many other law firm needs. when you're running your own law firm, it can be difficult to stay on top of follow-ups, keep track of details and communication, and stay aware of what needs to be done next on each project. Daylight organizes everything in one place, so you don't have to rely on your memory to keep it all straight. If you're feeling like it's time to upgrade from spreadsheets to a CRM, check out Daylight. You can download it from the App Store or visit www.marketcircle.com and try it free for 30 days. On top of that, you can get your first month free when you tell them you heard about Daylight here on The Law Entrepreneur. Daylight by Market Circle, staying top of mind without the stress. I mean, I remember when the whole concept of virtual assistants was getting started, there were a number of companies. A couple of them went under dramatically and left people hanging. I can remember one that I was using at the time that all of a sudden overnight stopped working. But you know, that's changed dramatically. And as you said, it's now a refined part of the business structure, and you can advertise for a virtual assistant, engage them online, vet them, work with them. If it works out, great. If it doesn't, you can say, thanks, this didn't work out, and move on and start right again with somebody different. It's just a very fluid and dynamic process. Tell me how you're managing that aspect of it.
I mean, basically what I do is I just have certain people that I rely on now. Okay. So I just started using Law Clerk for lawyers. Okay. Yep. And I like it a lot because I had some complaints I needed drafted, which they did a great job on. But I just use the assistants to get like medical records or just to fill out forms and things like that. So it's pretty, it's really easy. It's really easy to manage it because they know what I need done, and I just kind of send a request over and get it done, get sent back to me, and or even sent into the comp commission sometimes. It all depends on what I need done at the time. So,
and just to follow up with Law Clerk there, we've had Greg Garman, who's the CEO of and founder of Law Clerk, on the program a couple of times. You can listen to those episodes. Episode 123, I think, was his first time on the show. And then we also had him talking about freelance attorneys on episode 222. So 123 and 222, about 100 nice episodes apart. And nice. Law Clerk is a really interesting virtual assistant platform because, again, if you listen to those episodes, you'll understand that all of those virtual assistants are, in fact, licensed U.S. attorneys.
Correct.
Right. So to get real legal work done, that's one option for you. To get, as you said, medical record retrieval and some other administrative work done, do you use, a different platform? Do you use like Upwork or Indeed, or who are you using for that?
No, I just have somebody that I have a person that I've been using forever.
That's all right. So independent
virtual assistant. So
independent assistant that you hired and who works virtually.
Right.
And so one of the challenges with creating a virtual staff is trying to figure out how to parcel out the work.
Right.
I know a lot of attorneys will say, well, I want to wait till I have enough work that I can give a virtual assistant so I can employ one virtual assistant full time and can, just treat them as a virtual employee, which I gather is a little bit what you're doing. The other option is I want to break the work up into multiple clumps of work or kinds of work and have a virtual assistant for each of those, which may only be, a few hours a week.
Right. Well, what I do is I have my regular person that I use, but sometimes I have overflow and then I'll go to like Indeed or Upwork, okay, or one of those. And then I can, if it's just something that's easy to get done that doesn't require a lot of explanation. Right. Obviously I'm using the person. I have a couple of different ones, one for real estate, one for workers' comp. I use them for their specialized knowledge. They already know what, I just have to say, here's the file and they know what to do. I don't need to Right. I don't need to tell them anything. So
yeah. So I think you are more specifically in that first type where you have essentially a virtual employee.
Correct.
Yeah. So it's not everybody, you know, can do that, but you know, it's one option. As I said, you know, there's multiple ways. I know a couple of the folks that we've had on the podcast have dozens and dozens.
Right.
Virtual assistants. And they all have very, very discrete tasks. And he manages, you know, that whole process by the workflow is from one virtual assistant to another.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, it can go either way, obviously.
Yeah. I don't think there's one right or wrong.
Right. Approach. Right. Yeah. I mean, what I will, for my virtual assistants, that's for the specific practice areas. So like workers' comp and real estate, they need to have a little knowledge about the forms and, you know, the customs. But if it's some, you know, if it's like, I'm actually starting, I've been doing a lot more trademarks. So for that, I'm actually right in the process of exploring virtual assistants for that area.
To assist in that practice area.
Right. Because I think it would be more suited. You don't need to have as much knowledge to fill out a trademark application. I mean, I need to tell them what category, but once I tell them that, they should be able to fill it out.
So now you have, you know, essentially your staff, it's virtualized. You're able to work anywhere and everywhere using the tools that you have. You've got multiple offices to meet folks in so you can get around the Connecticut, New York area. So that's not an area that's devoid of other attorneys. The competition with other attorneys for work is pretty stiff in that region. How are you managing your marketing approach?
I do everything, anything and everything. I do have a website. I do blog posts. I've got SEO. I do Facebook ads. I post a lot on Facebook. I do podcasts like this. I speak to a lot live. My book gets my name out there for the entertainment things and for the voiceover things. So I'm always commenting on things that I see in those areas on social media. I do many different ways to stay out there in front of the public eye.
Now, I noticed a lot of what you talked about is all kind of focused on, you know, the electronic world as opposed to face-to-face, you know, networking, which I think is where everybody is heading these days. Did you do your own website or did you have a service that helped you with that?
I originally had done my own website and then I just recently hired a service to do it to help me fix the SEO and get the blog.
I went through the same because of time. I went through the same flow. I started off hiring somebody and then I took it back over and I built it with a site builder and then I turned it over to somebody else and then I took it back over and now I've turned it over to somebody else. And so it's one of those things that you can spend a lot of time, money and effort.
Exactly.
On. All right. So let's now talk a little bit about, you know, this kind of odd marriage between your legal practice and your dreams and realizations of being an actor and a voiceover actor. What's the story there? How'd you get started? Why is this such a fit for you?
Sure. I mean, it's when you first hear about it, it seems like it's odd, but it really isn't. So back in the mid 2000s, you know, when I before I had made the major transition, I was still with Travelers, the insurance company, insurance defense firm. And I've always wanted to do something in the entertainment field. I was a DJ in college. Okay. So I was just flipping through an adult education book and I saw a class about voiceovers and I thought it looked interesting. So I took the class and I realized, well, this is interesting. I want to do this. So I did a demo. I started sending it out. At that time, there was there was voice websites that were popping up that you can get work, you know, where people looking for voiceover artists would post on these websites and you would do an audition or send your demo in and they would hire you. You know, they're big now, but they were just starting out then. So shortly after I did my demo, my first demo, I got a job on the American Experience TV series where I narrated a couple of voices where I translated them from foreign language to English. And so that was on national television. Campbell Scott is the narrator in that show. That was how I started in the voiceover world. And what had happened from that point is, you know, I was just doing voiceover work. I was going to conferences and meeting other voiceover artists, and they all found out that I was a lawyer. So I started getting all these questions.
Sure.
Should I set up an LLC? Mm-hmm. Should I trademark my name? I need to do a contract. Do you have a contract? You know, those kind of questions. So I wrote them all down, and I wrote a book called Voiceover Legal. And Voiceover Legal hit number one on the bestseller list a few years back. It's still in like in the top 10 for entertainment law on Amazon. So now I'm like the go-to guy in the voiceover field for those types of, you know, reviewing contracts, doing contracts, trademarks. So that's how my name got out there. That's how they ended up merging the acting and the film.
It's the age old story where somebody's passion becomes part of their legal practice area.
Correct. You know,
it happens all the time. And it's really what makes solo practices, and I think solo and small firms, because, you know, big firms, you couldn't take advantage of that maybe to the same degree that you have thus far. I think it's what makes them interesting. And when people say niche down, niche your practice down, I know a lot of attorneys think, well, where do I start? Well, start with what you love doing. It doesn't have to be, you know, for me, back in the day, it was practicing the martial arts. I probably should have done, you know, been the martial arts lawyer when I went to law school and, you know, advised people how to set up martial arts studio. I wasn't bright enough to recognize that as a solo niche, but
absolutely. Yeah, you want to take niche down by taking things that you would, that when they walk in the door, you jump up and down and are like, yes, instead of, oh, I got to take another one of these cases. Yes, that's right. Kind of how I look at it.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about voiceover work, I think people always view it as being in the entertainment industry. And you were lucky that you had, you know, a TV show that picked you up and signed you for a voiceover job, you know, pretty soon. And you've continued with that. But I would argue that there's just as much, if not more, voiceover work in the business world.
Yes.
These days, with companies doing their own videos, and they want to have a, you know, a good voice behind their promotional videos and commercials that run on business platforms as opposed to run on TV and video platforms. I think there's a lot of work, if not more work, in that area.
Oh, absolutely. 1,000%.
Share that opinion?
I absolutely share that opinion. It's actually the e-learning area is probably the biggest area right now. You know, all the videos that for corporations that show whatever policy that they're trying to teach their employees, that kind of thing, or, you know, instruction manuals, e-learning. I think that's the biggest, and it is mostly corporate. So I agree with you.
Yeah.
Commercials are a very small portion of the business. You know, TV voiceovers on commercials that you still hear on the radio or see on TV, it's a small portion, small percentage.
Well, it's the same issue in entertainment with those who are on the stage or in front of the camera versus those who are in the wings and behind the camera. There's a lot of work in the wings and behind the camera. You may find your niche there much more readily than the highly competitive world of trying to get a stage role or a film role or a voice role on TV or film.
Well, today the opportunities exist to create your own content as well. Much easier. So then that's actually, now I'm a film producer, and the way I got into that was, you know, once people knew I was a voiceover attorney, then filmmakers started asking me questions and wanted me to work on their films and, you know, get their contracts done. And so I went out to AFM, American Film Market, a couple of years, and I actually, I went up and down every single floor and I handed out my card to all the people that were displaying there, all the exhibitors. And I got a whole bunch of work from that.
Interesting. And
so that, you know, once I started doing the legal work for producers, then they started asking me, well, can you help me? Can you be a producer on this film and help me cast it and do this and that? So that's how I started producing. And now I produce my own content. So I get in front of the camera too, because I take parts if I can on films that I'm actually producing. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, that keeps you busy. It generates income, and it also keeps your passion alive. You know, it's a great way to be a lawyer, be an actor, be a producer. You know, you can do all of those things all at the same time, which is, it's amazing how it all meshes and comes together.
Yeah. So the synergy of those roles are very integrated. It works well together. I'm curious as to whether or not you've seen any interest by bar associations in what you have to offer, perhaps to their members. Have you had any kind of contact in that area?
Yes. In fact, the class I was telling you about, where the seminar that I did, the actor and the litigator, that was for the Connecticut Bar Association.
Okay.
And they wanted us to come back in the spring, but then of course, COVID.
Right.
So hopefully we'll be back.
The corollary to that is, how about on the actor side? I know you're a member of SAG. My daughter's a member of SAG as well.
Yep.
Have you seen any outreach from them to your legal side?
Yes. Yes. Okay. That's the funny thing. See, in the legal circles, I'm known as the actor.
Right. The actor circles.
The actor circle, I'm known as the lawyer.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying it's, they're so merged. So yes, I do seminars. In fact, I just got a call yesterday from a new songwriting clinic. They're starting up here in Connecticut, and they want me to go talk about the legal aspects. So just yesterday I got that phone call.
Yeah.
So, and then of course there's a potential source of clients too. When I go in there and talk to all these songwriters about legal, setting up LLCs and all the legal issues that come along with songwriting, you know, then, so that's another way that I get clients, and I can face that face to face too, which has started to come back a little bit now, which is nice.
Good. Well, listen, Robert, this has been great. I think we could spend a lot of time here continuing to chat, but I want to respect your time, because I know you're wearing a lot of hats these days. So tell our audience how they can reach out to you if they're interested in following up with anything you had to offer today.
Sure. My attorney website is robsigesq.com. And my acting website is robpaglia.com. And you can find me on IMDb as well. If you want anyone interested in the book that's on Amazon, it's called Voiceover Legal, or you can go to voiceoverlegal.com for a copy of the book.
Awesome. We will have all of that in our show notes for those of you who are in the car or on the treadmill and are out for a run. And Rob, it's been a delight chatting with you. Let's stay in touch. And thanks for taking the time to be with me today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Great. My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists, Daylight, and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com, or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility, and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.